This is Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Expert hosts like William Henry on secrets of the past, Jim Mars on politics and conspiracy, Marla Fries on psychic phenomena, Anne Strieber on matters of the spirit, and Whitley Strieber on aliens, UFOs, and who knows what else. And weekly science reporter Emmy Award winner Linda Moulton Howe. We say it like it is. We take you deeper, down where the real secrets lie. Dreamland. Welcome to the edge of the world.
This week's Dreamland is one of the most extraordinary that I have ever recorded. I will be talking to a scientist we're calling John Smith because he cannot afford to let the scientific community know what happened to him. What happened to him is this. In February of 2008, he was appalled to wake up and discover himself in the process of being implanted by aliens. He went to Dr. Roger Lear without telling Dr. Lear what was wrong with him. And Dr. Lear will be telling that story in the subscriber section. Dr. Lear, in treating his foot, coincidentally found what the scientist already knew or suspected was there, an implant in one of his toes. There followed the most exhaustive study of any such object ever carried out, as far as we know, outside of secret government on planet Earth. This object is provably not from this planet, provably. And hopefully we will have a complete file of the report in the subscriber section this weekend. We may have it maybe a little late, but we will get it shortly. So it will be there and downloadable and readable by our subscribers. Part of it will be available as well in the free section of the website. So this is going to be a truly amazing Dreamland. Get set for it. I have already recorded it. I know what is said in it. And believe you me, you are going to be shocked, but even more extraordinary. He's not the only scientist we have recently met who is coming into contact. The visitors, the Grays, are extending their involvement into the scientific community. Right now, these men have to remain extremely secretive because their careers would be immediately ruined in this insane world. And yet, they are benefiting in some cases from their contact experiences and even using the information that they're gaining in their work. So listen up when we get in just a few minutes. It's going to be quite amazing. Next week, we're going to take on 2012 in a scientific manner with Apocalypse 2012. And you're going to be real surprised at what this very conservative scientific mind has come up with and why he thinks we should look real closely in the direction of 2012. Now in the news, cat mutilations are back in Miami-Dade County, Florida this time. There is a story in the Out There section on unknowncountry.com. It'll probably appear in the news as well. The fact is that cats are being killed in Miami-Dade County, mutilated, left on display in the yards of family homes. Some skinned, some others sliced across the stomach, the bodies left like talismans in a horror movie. Now, does this sound at all familiar? It does indeed, because it's happened in Austin. It's happened in San Diego. It's happened in cities all over the world. But do the officials know that in Miami-Dade County? Absolutely not. Because of our agreed-upon international silence about the UFO and close encounter phenomenon and possible alien connections to such things, they have no idea it's ever happened anywhere else. And yet it happens, as you know, all the time. The Humane Society of the United States has announced a $2,500 reward leading to an arrest and conviction in what they said were serial cat killings. Well, you should, let's hope that this does not once again go around the world as it did the last time cat mutilations appeared. Linda Moulton Howe, who we greatly miss on Dreamland, literally tracked a series of cat mutilation events all around the planet. Is this really an ordinary serial cat killer doing this? Somehow, I don't think so. A researcher in Australia may have found the smoking gun, an alien signal. That's right, an alien signal. He has detected a suspicious signal last December. He did not exactly crack open a bottle of champagne after he detected it, but because he was concerned that perhaps it was caused by a glitch in his instrumentation or some unknown random noise or a rogue astrophysical phenomenon. However, what is so remarkable is that this is not a radio signal. He hasn't even been looking for radio signals. He has been looking for lasers. That's right. He's been looking for lasers in outer space, and this is a laser pulse. We don't know of any natural processes that would generate laser pulses, although, of course, we also don't know that much about our universe, so they could be out there. In any case, he is continuing to examine that same area of sky again and again and again every night in hopes of detecting another pulse from it. And if he does, this could turn out to be the first verifiable signal from an alien intelligence, not necessarily directed at us, but which we are coincidentally able to pick up. And incidentally, I do hope if you are planning to go to the Dreamland Festival that you sign up relatively soon. The Scarrett Bennett Center is already sold out on rooms for Friday night, which would mean that if you do sign up, they will direct you to another nearby hotel. But it is not something to wait on. I would do it relatively soon. Roger Marsh of the UFO Examiner, examiner.com, reports UFO traffic regularly, and his reports have gotten really, really busy lately. For Wednesday, last Wednesday, May 20th, 11 sightings over 7 states. This is pretty unprecedented, and we are seeing this all over the world. Of course, in the United States, sightings, all UFO material is now ghettoized into the examiner.com and a couple of other locations. It is not normally reported in the local newspapers and local press anymore at all, which is fantastic because the closer they come, the farther away we seem to be stepping. In any case, there were, there was a big UFO flap in Arizona, which turned out to be a NASA balloon, at least so NASA said, but of course one never knows these days. The United States continues to show no sign whatsoever of changing its position on UFO disclosure, as a result of which extraordinary information and extraordinary knowledge continue to just be wasted and to fall by the wayside instead of being studied. And when you listen to John Smith and you listen to Dr. Roger Lear, you'll understand just how tragic that is, that not only could we learn a great deal from what we are finding, but about ourselves and the world around us and about our visitors, we could step up to a whole new level of understanding and being in this universe. It's quite tragic indeed. Now, we'll be right back, and when we come back, as I say sometimes on Dreamland, and I mean it this time, big time, fasten your seatbelts.
You're listening to Dreamland. Serious wonder spoken here. Don't miss the Dreamland Festival, June 26th to June 28th. Get your tickets now by clicking on the store tab on unknowncountry.com, then going to The Latest. Do it now. Tickets will run out. Listen to what Whitley Strieber has planned.
I'm going to be talking about some deeply personal material that I have never brought forward before, but also a new discovery. I've been working on a new book, and I believe that I have discovered the mechanism that makes white powder gold work and possibly one of the great secrets of the lost human civilization of the deep past. And I'm going to be talking about those things too, as well as on Sunday morning, there will be a meditation with me. So don't miss it. Click on that store tab right away. Welcome, folks. This is a historic Dreamland broadcast. I have somebody with us about whom I can tell you almost nothing, not even his name. We're going to call him John Smith, Mr. Smith or John. And the reason is that he is a prominent member of the scientific community. He has an implant that has been removed from his body, and we're going to be talking about that object. And for you, those of you who are not unknowncountry.com subscribers, you will be able to download a PDF file of the first five or so pages of his, of the extraordinary and incredibly detailed scientific report on this object. And for subscribers, you will be able to download the full file from the unknowncountry.com subscriber section, and that will be announced when the program airs. John Smith, without even saying where you work, I will say welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Willie.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on. Of course, I know John Smith by his real name quite well. And John, I think the way to start here is for you to tell us a little bit about the kind of science you do.
Well, I'm a material scientist, and I'm currently working on a carbon nanotube project. I invented a process to put almost any desired metal inside carbon nanotubes, or coat the material on the surface of the carbon nanotubes to change their properties for various industrial applications like metal matrix composites, supercapacitors for energy storage, sensors, there's many other applications. And to back up a little bit, carbon nanotubes are very, very small sheets of carbon rolled into a tube, and they have unique electrical and thermal and mechanical strength properties. Are the world's strongest known material. They have a strength to weight ratio about 100 times that of steel superalloys, and they have the metallic types of nanotubes conduct electricity extremely well. It's the next best thing to a superconductor. And there's also semiconducting carbon nanotubes that could be used in carbon nanotube electronics in the future. And so this is cutting-edge research at the present time. It's one of the hottest areas in material science research on CNTs.
Now, as you know from our conversations and from your conversations with him, you are not the only scientist working in an incredibly sensitive and important area who has had close encounters of the third kind. Folks, there is another scientist out there, equally prominent, who not only has had encounters, but has gotten information from the visitors during the encounters that has helped him in his work. His work is world famous. So we have two such people now who are coming forward in a slightly obviously disguised way, because they can't afford to let this out. What would happen, John, to your career if this was known?
Well, I'm really not sure if anything bad would happen or not. It's safe to assume that any changes in my career would be negative as a result.
Yes.
The man you mentioned is afraid of the same thing. He definitely does not want this information out, but he's in contact with the visitors, the aliens, whatever you wish to call them.
Yes. His experience has been rather different from yours, in that his experience has been pretty positive. And as we get into what happened to you, I don't think I think you'll be telling us a different story. And we have a question from one of our listeners that you sort of began to answer, but let's go back to it. Do you know each other, these two scientists, and tell us how you met?
Yeah, I just talked to him a few days ago, as a matter of fact, he's a very interesting guy, and is doing some very interesting space-related research, and it's been a pleasure knowing him. And I got to know him through a convention that you and I went to, and then right. Ann introduced us via email, and we started having phone conversations.
Yes, the Ann Streber factor. She yeah. put the two of you together. She's dangerous, that lady. In any case, let's now go back to something you touched on just a moment ago, and that is this. You mentioned that carbon nanotubes might be used in electronics. Would that include communications technology?
Oh, sure.
You know where I'm going, but our listeners don't yet. But we're going to go to a very interesting place here in just a minute, folks. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Carbon nanotube electronics could definitely be used in communications. I just did a seminar about carbon nanotube electronics the other day, and it turns out that if you could perfect the process for making carbon nanotube transistors and diodes, they would have much higher performance than silicon and germanium transistors and diodes and electronic components in general that we have today on integrated circuits. So you could use carbon nanotube electronics potentially for anything you could use conventional electronics for.
With the difference that they would be, what would be the difference?
They'd be a lot faster, and the amount of current they can carry for their size is a lot greater.
So you would have potentially a much more powerful, much smaller, much faster device.
That's correct. You could make faster computers that would consume less power, and you could make power-type semiconductors that would carry a lot more power with less heating and be more efficient.
I see. So we have another listener question. What are the nanostructures like? What kind of scale are you talking about when you talk about the nanotubes you're working on?
Well, the single wall carbon nanotubes are between 0.6 nanometers and about 1.5 to 2 nanometers in diameter. A nanometer is 10 angstroms, and an angstrom is just less than the size of the average atom. So we're talking, you know, between 6.5 and 20 atoms in diameter. So they're very, very small. They're, you know, human hair is gigantic compared to these things. There's also multi-wall carbon nanotubes that are larger in diameter, but even they're less than 100 nanometers in diameter.
Well, I don't ever get into, one of the reasons I don't get into whether or not people work on classified things is that it is not legal to ask somebody, if you know them, to be working on classified projects. It is illegal to ask them what it is. In other words, you're violating the National Security Act if you say to someone who you know to be working on a classified project what's going on. Now, I do not know of John working on any classified projects at all. So I just say that outright. But I do know, of course, that there must be some very sensitive industrial processes you're working on. And now that's going to get me to the next place I want to go, which is the question of why. The other scientist who was involved in this, it's really pretty clear why he is being involved by the visitors because of the work he does in space science. It's so directly connected. However, I think of your work as being somewhat less directly connected, and yet maybe not. Could you sort of tell us what you think their interest in your work, if they have any interest in your work, might be? You might have some indications. And later, John Smith is going to tell us some of the most extraordinary close encounter stories you've ever heard. But let's start there.
Well, I'm not sure if they're directly interested in my work or not. If they are, I think they're interested because they are trying to give us, or give me at least, the technology to create some of these devices that they are using. They're very good at nanotechnology. Their implants and probes and their technology in general is heavily based on nanotechnology, which we're just now starting to explore. So if they're interested in my work, to give us more nanotechnology, a technology base.
And you're literally right there, right at the leading edge of this exploration. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So And so is he. He's at the leading edge of a certain type of space exploration that we are working very hard on.
Yeah, I would certainly certainly say that's a correct assessment. Some of the stuff he's come up with is incredible.
Yeah, I know it. And some of the stuff you've come up with is incredible, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, okay, now let's get on. We're getting toward the end of the first segment. And let's talk first a little bit about your own background. And then we're going to get into this object, which you folks, this man knows more about this object than anyone has ever known about any implant that's ever been removed. And for the simple reason that he is a scientist, he has access to many people highly placed in the scientific community and to equipment that, quite frankly, those of us who are researching this could never even begin to afford to use. So this is remarkable. Now, when did you first notice the presence of these visitors in your life?
Well, I noticed it when I was a child. I remember an incident when I was 5 years old where I had an experience that that I thought was a dream at the time, but it was almost too real to be a dream. And it involved seeing about a 50-foot diameter yellow glowing UFO hovering over my parents' house, the house where I grew up, at about 4 o'clock in the morning, just before sunrise. And when I woke up, I had a severe nosebleed. There was blood all over the bed, blood all over my chest, and I had vague recollections of someone putting something up my nose with a long probe. In a very similar manner to how you described that procedure in communion.
Yes.
Really. So I certainly have reason to believe I have a brain implant of some kind that dates from that time, and I think that's a standard procedure for these people.
Well, I don't think we have the technology to, at least we haven't had the technology to access those such implants, but we do have the technology to access other types of implants, and
yeah.
You were talking to a man now who has held in his own hands an implant that came out of his body, and we'll be right back.
This is Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Expert hosts, unique information.
Yeah.
We're talking to John Smith. John Smith is a prominent member of the scientific community working in the cutting-edge area of carbon nanotubes, and he has had close encounter experiences of the third kind. Before we left the air, John Smith told us of his first encounter. John, why don't we move forward a little bit now and I would like to ask you if you were aware of when the implant that was removed was put into your body.
Yeah, I know the exact date. It was February 28th of last year. And so that's kind of what makes my case unique. That's part of the factors that I know the exact date it was put in. That's here pretty uncommon, as most people would have implants, just got them when they were children and don't know the exact date.
Yeah, well, it's the same with me. I don't know the exact date, but I certainly remember the month mine was put in, and it was May of 1989.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, well, it was I was wide awake when it happened. It was definitely something that I was aware of. I was totally conscious of it from the moment it happened. Now, so describe for us exactly what transpired on that night.
Well, my daughter had just been born a couple months before, and my wife and my other children were staying over at my in-law's house because her mother was helping her with the baby. And I stopped by our house to water my plants after work, and did some other stuff around the house, and I became tired and didn't want to drive the 20 miles back to our in-law's place, and so I just phoned my wife and told her I was going to stay at the house that night, and shortly after that, I saw two huge raccoons in the backyard, which I thought was really unusual. One of them was like 70 pounds. I'd never seen anything that big before.
Could you repeat that? I don't know if I didn't hear it, and I'm not sure the listeners did. What did you see?
I saw two huge raccoons in
Raccoons. Oh, yes. It's a familiar to many of us who've had close encounter experiences, the animals that aren't quite what they seem.
Right. They seemed tame almost, and the cat wasn't scared of them. I thought that was very strange. And I fed the animals some cat food and watched them for a while, and then went inside and went to bed. And I woke up about 8 the following morning, and I went to bed about 11, and I woke up at 8 the following morning, and the side of my head hurt, and my toe had a burning sensation in it. And I looked at it, and there were 2 puncture wounds on the bottom of it. And I put it under, put my toe under a UV light, and one of the puncture wounds lit up bright green.
Why did you think to put it under a UV light?
Because I remembered that the visitors had been there in the middle of the night, and that I had 2 more implants. I didn't remember anything else at that time. But
you did have a definite memory of what kind of visitors?
I was pretty sure it was the Greys. I did not have any memories of who did it. I just knew that they had been there in the middle of the night, and that I had 2 more implants. Later on, I underwent regressive hypnosis and found out exactly what happened that night.
Now, here are some comments coming in from our listeners. Quote, that's the second person I've heard say they fed the visitors cat food. Wild. I would agree with that. I have to tell you that this experience is so seamlessly real when it's happening to you. You really don't know exactly what you're doing. Another great comment, 70-pound raccoons, they might as well not even have bothered to disguise themselves. And they had been in your life for a while, hadn't they, by then?
Yeah.
I mean, since you were 5, but you were having close encounters before then. When was the first adult close encounter that you remember?
Well, back in 1987, I was driving on Highway 40 eastbound from Needles after visiting Bullhead City, and we're on our way back, and I was driving along. We were between Needles and Ludlow on 40, and I looked down at the clock, and it was 11 o'clock, and then what seemed like about 30 seconds later, I looked at the clock again, and it was 2 a.m. That really just threw me for a loop. And
yeah, that's exciting when it happens. I've had that experience.
Yeah, and my watch had gone forward as well. And then I just to make sure, I stopped in Ludlow and looked at the clock at the gas station, and it was indeed 2 a.m. in the morning. So 3 hours had gone someplace. And I didn't know what had happened that night for a long time, but I recently underwent hypnosis about that incident too, and found out what occurred, and it was definitely visitor related.
Yes, so and when you say visitor related, what did you find out?
I found out that they told me to stop the car. It was a white light shined on the car. They told me to stop. I stopped, and a visitor that seemed to be a high-ranking individual beamed in by the driver's side of the car, and he had on a cobalt blue uniform and had a sidearm. I think the government calls them flash tube weapons, and he was annoyed with me for not stopping the car fast enough to suit him. I'd speeded up and tried to get away before I reverted to the mental state I'm in when I'm with them.
Now, let's talk about 2 things. First, you mentioned a sidearm.
Yeah.
Could you expand on that a little bit?
It looks kind of like a flashlight, but it's shorter, and it's got a lens-looking device on the end that's red or orange, and it's similar to a phaser from Star Trek.
Yeah. And what does it do?
Oh, it'll blow a 6-inch hole in you.
So, in other words, now, am I understanding, do you think there was some kind of connection going on here with some kind of government aspect to this? U.S., I mean?
No.
No.
No, I don't think so at all.
But this is the reason I'm asking is this is the first time I've ever heard anyone mention the existence of any kind of armaments in connection with this. So, you know, you must be a real, real obstreperous case, is all I can say. Most of us, I think, just you know, pretty much are easy to control.
Could you repeat that?
Yeah, most of us are pretty easy to control. And
I've acted up on occasion in the past. I have memories of that, so maybe that's what they were thinking of. But I'm pretty cooperative with them now and have been for a long time. But he was just annoyed with me, and I think that these people, high-ranking people, get to carry these sidearms because for show, if nothing else. These people, one thing I figured out is these people are basically a high-tech foreign military that are here on a mission. Their mission is multifaceted. And one of the things that they do is get locals that they consider reliable and get them to help them. And I get the impression I'm somewhat important to them, but you know, maybe they do consider me an obstreperous case. I don't know.
Now, you say they're on a multifaceted mission. Could you describe some aspects of that mission as you understand it?
They have large-scale mining operations both on the Earth and on the Moon, and they take people to get DNA and samples of tissues. And
why would they do that?
I think they're using it for the hybrid program.
I see. So they're making human-alien hybrids. Of course, I would agree with that because I've actually had a relationship with more than one of them and have seen one. I'm going to write a book, by the way, folks, about my real relationship with one of them, and it's going to be called A Book of Fiction, but it isn't, and you will all know the truth when you read it. Because I can't make it nonfiction, and it's useless to do that in this culture. But that aside, they're making human alien hybrids, and what would you say that would be for?
I think they want to infiltrate them into our society. I'm not sure if they're planning on taking over or anything, but they want to have influence over our society. I'm pretty sure of that, and they're also involved in, maybe this is probably going to be pretty controversial, but I certainly have reason to believe that they're involved in a massive operation to genetically engineer the human race. They're going both directions. They make hybrids that have mostly alien DNA, and they also take human fetuses in utero and modify them to have some either alien DNA or souped-up human genes to have characteristics that they desire.
I am aware of a child, I won't say his age or anything, who is probably such a being and who looks a lot like me, and yet I've never even met his mother, supposedly. We've never met. So I know what you're talking about, and it seems to me that they're doing everything. Now, here's a question. Some of our listeners are a little confused about what you're talking about. Are these grays or something else? Who are they?
These are the grays. Yeah.
Do you have any sense of what they are? Because I'll give you an example. There are channelers out there who say that the grays are just a sort of machine and that they're run by a species of sort of hyperdimensional reptilians. Does that make any sense to you? Do you have any response to that?
I don't think they're machines. I think they're biological. They're beings. They seem mechanical compared to humans. The ones I've seen don't have as strong emotions in general as humans do. But they're definitely not machines. They have some emotion, and they're biological. And I think most likely they're a made-up species that somebody else created. Maybe the reptilians created them. I don't know. I don't remember meeting any reptilians. But some people say they're working with reptilians.
Well, I've never met a reptilian, and I don't even know that they exist, quite frankly. And
well, I couldn't prove it myself. I've never seen any, but.
No, and here's some comments. My guide has emotions, one of them says. One of our listeners says, and another listener agrees they do. And I had that experience, too. The one that is on the cover of Communion had a much more complex emotional life than mine, than a human one. And I know that for sure, because I got to know this being quite well over the years. And this was an immensely complicated being. So maybe they are sort of hierarchical, and the farther up you go, the more fully expressed they are as independent.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, they're a definite hierarchical society. They're very, very structured, and, there's different castes. There's the worker caste and the scientist, leader caste, and then there's the upper caste that are the praying mantis type ones. And, one thing to keep in mind, too, and they're all linked together telepathically. These beings are true telepaths.
Oh, that's true. I've been in that linkage from time to time, and it's really remarkable.
Yeah, I think I am too. The communication is only two way when they want it to be, but
right.
I certainly have reason to believe they're monitoring me at all times. And one thing to keep in mind too is that these beings can. You pointed this out too. Is these beings can make you see and feel things that seem absolutely real. So we don't really know for sure what they're like. It could be a deception on their part.
Well, listen, you know, you anticipated almost psychically a question being asked by one of the listeners, and we'll find out what that question is in just a moment. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Dreamland. Serious wonder spoken here.
We're talking today to John Smith. John Smith is a scientist. He works in the area of nanotechnology and carbon nanotubes, and he is also a close encounter witness. And in just a moment, we are going to be getting into more detail about what exactly was found in his body. And for those of you who are subscribers, we're going to be talking further with that to Dr. Roger Lear in the subscriber section. Now, just before we left, there was a very interesting question about, and let me see if I can find it now. Can they technologically cause emotions, or is it some kind of a soul skill, do you think? Or do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, I don't think they need any technology to do that, at least not if you're physically present. They have, technology that can amplify their power that they can use to cause monitor you and cause you to see and feel things from a much greater distance.
Exactly.
But in general, it's something that's innate to them.
Now you participated extensively in the analysis of your own implant.
Yeah.
Obviously, you had unique equipment. Could you tell us a little bit about first what did you experience any difference after it came out?
Yeah, I felt kind of strange when it was in there. I felt like my emotions were being constrained or my thoughts were being constrained, something like that. And when it was taken out, I felt kind of more free to think and experience what I wanted to. It was very subtle, but it was a definite difference. And I know other people have commented similarly when they've had implants removed. So some of these implants have something to do with mind control. And in my case, I think they put this implant in not because they thought I needed it, but because they wanted me to find it. I think it was just part of a plan. They wanted us to analyze it and to for me to get in contact with the UFO community and for this information to get out. They waited a great deal of time waiting for orders before they put it in, and I think they were trying to finally make up their mind because and hash it all out because they knew that that I was going to start an investigation and get it taken out if they put it in.
Do you have the sense that they wanted you to take it out, or?
Oh yeah, I think it was part of this. This whole thing was part of a plan.
They
work from very complex plans. They have the ability to plan much more intricately and farther into the future than we do.
Oh yes, I think that they can see into time and not in a. I'm not so sure that you would say it was a time machine, but I think their minds are very clear, and they can see inevitabilities in the future much more clearly than we can. So
They have a collective. They have a collective that's partly computer assisted.
Right, exactly. Something like that must be going on. Let me ask you a kind of an outside of the box question. Do you have any sense of ever having gone anywhere with them?
Yeah, absolutely. I have memories of being to the moon a couple of times. They have a base on the far side, a massive base on the far side, I might add. There's a glass building about a mile on a side where they do spacecraft repair and assembly. It's almost in the middle of the far side, not too far from Tsiolkovsky Crater. And I have some memories of being there at least twice. And I met somebody that's also in contact with the visitors a few months back, and he said that I was with him on a visit to the alien home planet. I don't remember that myself, but seeing pictures that people have drawn of it, it looks familiar.
Yeah, you know, I have similar and incredibly poignant memories that haunt me. You know, one of the listeners was very astute. He said, "Did you just touch your implant, Whitley?" And the answer is yes, I did, because it is active right now. It's quite hot. And,
I'm sure. Yeah.
So I think this is a pretty hot show as far as the visitors are concerned. Because, you know, right now this stuff is all kind of under the radar. But when it goes above the radar, all of this work that we're going to do now, every detail of everything we say, everything we do now, will become a part of human history. And the visitors know that. And they also know when that change will take place, because it's, of course, up to them. Government disclosure is not really relevant, I don't think. But we won't get into that. Let's continue on with the implant. Okay, the implant is taken out. And you begin analysis of it. What did you first do? And by the way, folks, this has been at more than one laboratory. It wasn't just John Smith's analysis. Not to say that that was a gist, but I mean, he did have it in his body, and for him to be analyzing it, you know, it's been amply verified and beyond that. So, but first, what was done?
Well, the first thing we did, of course, was take X-rays, and it was in the body, and verify that an object was there by both conventional X-ray and CAT scan, and then we did radio frequency analysis and found out the object was emitting radio frequencies in the megahertz and gigahertz and ELF bands. ELF is extremely low frequency, and it's a band that can be used for mind control, which I thought was very suggestive.
Yes.
And
Wait, let's go back there. That was really fascinating. Expand on a little bit about what you mean by this band being used for mind control.
Well, ELF is a band that is used for transmission of information through the Earth to communicate with submarines, and it's also a band that is used by the body. And
right, it's the
ELF radio can have physiological effects on the nervous system because
The signal being emitted by the planet, very, very long, extra long, very long waves are constantly coming out of the planet, and
that's right.
The brain responds by generating a harmonic of such a wave.
Yeah, there's the brain appears to be in resonance with the ELF in the ionospheric corridor.
Yes.
It's a very remarkable thing. It's called the Schumann resonance, and a lot of people don't know about that. I'm surprised that that's not in more of the textbooks.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the Schumann resonance is very important and probably very relevant to the way we are and how we think and what we are, because it's our basic link to the planet. And now suddenly, in your body, there is something with an entirely different link, but that is in that same profound electromagnetic region. That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They might be able to subtly tweak your nervous system by putting a slightly different ELF frequency into your nervous system.
And did you have any sense of being tweaked?
Yeah, like I say, I felt different.
Yeah.
I felt constrained somehow. The effect was very subtle, but I definitely felt different after it was removed, and I think that was probably a result of these ELF emissions that the object was giving off.
So it's removed, and some odd things happened subsequently, didn't they? Immediately after the removal.
Yeah, right before we went to do the radio frequency test, my car broke down in such a way that it looked like it had been hit by an energy pulse of some kind. The ignition system was completely burned out.
Yeah, I was among those waiting for you to arrive when that happened.
Yeah, Dr. Lear had to come pick me up, so
right.
That was rather interesting. And before that, the ground actually caught on fire in my backyard a few days prior to that, and it was very difficult to put out. And there's a similar phenomenon going on in the hillsides near where I live, and I have reason to believe it's because of energy transmitted to the ground by
yes.
UFOs that have landed.
Well, and, you know, that happened in Sicily a few years ago and was extensively investigated by the Italian government, and they finally basically said that the only real explanation was that there was some kind of non-human intelligence that had generated, and what was happening there was spontaneous fires in this village where electrical cords and so forth were just bursting into flames. Automobiles were being affected by it. They were catching fire. The locking systems were locking the cars down. And they found in a field nearby, and this is going to be relevant, folks, because when we get back, John Smith will tell us a similar story. They found in a field near this town in Sicily a free-floating electromagnetic field, a very high-intensity one, which couldn't be explained. And the trouble with this is you need an electromagnetic field doesn't propagate. It's generated by the magnet, and it stays in an area around the magnet. Now, that said, when we come back, we're going to tell you some of the most extraordinary things that you've ever heard, and we're going to really close the case. John Smith can prove that this object in him, that was in him, was not of this earth. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online.
We're talking to John Smith, a scientist who works in the area of carbon and nanotubes and very small technologies, who has had an implant removed. And we are now going to be talking about that implant. But John, first respond to the comment I made about the electromagnetic field in Sicily, because I already know what you're going to say, but my listeners do not.
Yeah, UFOs can leave magnetic and electrical traces of their presence, even in objects that don't normally magnetize. Like when Dr. Lear and I and a couple of MUFON volunteers investigated my house with a magnetometer, we found out that the avocado tree that those raccoons had been sitting in had a strong magnetic field of something on the order of 20 milligauss, and the leaves and the trunk of the tree were magnetized. That's really strange.
Yes,
things like that normally don't magnetize, and
right.
the grass was dead under the tree, and the delineation point where the grass where there was growing grass marked the delineation point of where the magnetic field ended.
Now, listener comments, and I think this is a good comment to repeat, folks who are listening in the recorded version. Magnetized wood, wild. That's right. What John has just told us about was a magnetized tree. That's right. Right.
Yeah, and kitchen utensils, including plastic ones in my kitchen, were magnetized. There was a very strong magnetic field on the wall right near where I sleep. And we found we did ultraviolet scans of the walls of my bedroom, and we found a bunch of yellow green stains on the wall, including some that looked like a couple of four fingered handprints. I took that section of the wall out and sent it in for DNA analysis. So hopefully we'll get some data out of that pretty soon.
Yeah, that's right. That takes a long time, DNA analysis, folks, and we are all eager to find out what we find out with this. Bearing in mind that when I tried to get some DNA analysis done of of a strange creature that was unearthed in South Texas during called the Elmendorf Beast. At first, I received a call from the laboratory saying that this was the strangest DNA they had ever seen, that it was not the DNA of any known animal. Then there was a six-month silence, and then we received a written report with just one line in it saying this was the DNA of a coyote. In other words, it took them 6 months, but they lied. And I hope that doesn't happen to you.
I hope so too. Well, that often happens where they find something unusual, and then they contact the authorities, or the authorities find out about it and contact them, and then tell them to keep it quiet, and then they give you a report like that that's obviously completely bogus.
Okay, now we've got
that doesn't happen to us.
We've got a number of questions coming in, but we're also running short on time. And what I would like to do now is for you to tell us exactly what it is about this object that makes you certain it could not have been manufactured in its entirety on this Earth.
Well, the object was basically metal with inclusions of a ceramic-like material, and the metal was very
carbon nanotubes.
Yes, the inclusions contained large concentrations of carbon nanotubes coated with calcium phosphate and magnesium phosphate and sulfates, and there's some titanium and other elements.
You work in the field of carbon nanotubes, and you ended up with an implant in you that had carbon nanotubes in it. I have a question. Was there anything about these nanotubes that was novel to you or that was useful to you?
Well, yeah, I'd never seen carbon nanotubes that were coated with calcium phosphate and magnesium phosphate and silica and the other things that that the carbon nanotubes had on them. It was almost like an insulating layer, like they were carbon nanotube wires. You'd want to put an insulating layer on the outside if you were going to make a carbon nanotube wire, and that certainly looked what these things looked like. And there were other larger carbon nanotube bundles on the outside of the device that looked like the main connections to it.
So
it was very, very interesting.
And, okay, so let's now go back. And what was I interrupted you, and what was it that exactly that told you that this was not of this Earth?
Well, carbon nanotubes are not found in nature as far as anybody knows, so
that's
a very strong indication. And the metal in the device was very similar to that of a nickel iron meteorite. It had gallium and germanium in the right amounts, and the nickel percentage, 5.2%, was within the percentages found in nickel iron meteorites, and it had a high concentration of phosphorus, which is very indicative, cobalt, and precious metals like iridium, which is hardly found at all on Earth, platinum, palladium, ruthenium, rhodium, and it had some rare earths in it, which is also indicative of some meteorites.
Yes.
And also the isotopic ratios were not terrestrial.
This is a very important comment, because we could not manufacture something with non-terrestrial isotopic ratios, could we?
Well, it would be extremely expensive and difficult, and it's almost inconceivable that somebody would go to that much trouble. And this device, I say device because that's certainly what it appears to be, had components in it, strange crystals that weren't of the natural shape, salt crystals that weren't of the natural shape that might have acted as resonators, horn-like elements of this carbon nanotube stuff that might have been antennae, and long bone-shaped things that might have been wires, and it was obviously a device, and
yes,
a device beyond our technology, I would say.
Now, a listener asks a question. What type of technology do you see being made by humans in, say, the next 10 years based on research trends? In other words, could we be going in the direction of being able to make something like this, I think is the question.
Yeah, I think that we certainly will be able to make something like this someday. I don't think that we're going to be able to do it in the next 10 years. This is a very, very sophisticated device, and One problem I could see is getting the carbon nanotube components inside the metal without destroying them.
Right.
They must have some very sophisticated means to do that that does not involve high temperatures and molten metal.
Yeah, because when I first heard this, that here you are a scientist that works on carbon nanotubes and you've got an implant that has carbon nanotubes in it, I thought to myself, is this for real? I mean, what is going on here? But then I learned more, and I learned that, you know, we don't even have the technology to create the structure that you found.
No, we don't. I think that they gave this to me partly as a gift, like I was saying, and very similar, in a very similar manner to how they gave the information to the other scientists that we were talking about earlier.
You know, someone mentioned something very fascinating right here. Interestingly, one of the people last week mentioned iridium, like in the implant, in the serpent mound. And what that was is, now, last week will be the show with Stephen Quayle that will be this weekend, because these shows are recorded live now, but broadcast later. And so the Great Serpent Mound in Ohio has got a lot of iridium in it, and no one knows why. It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very, very strange.
Very strange.
Yeah, maybe extraterrestrials occupied it in the past.
Or had something to do with something there. John Smith, we have reached the end of Dreamland together. And I think that I would love to have you back on at some point. And to perhaps do a show that would, or rather to come on and do a live chat with our subscribers. And it's not a voice chat, it's a text chat, and it's a lot of fun, and I'm wondering if you would be willing to do that on some Saturday morning, if that would be possible for you.
Oh yeah, I'd love to do it. That sounds great.
Wonderful. Then subscribers, we will be scheduling a live chat with John Smith after the show has aired and everybody's listened, because this has been a completely awesome experience of Dreamland for me. And I have to admit that for the first time in a long time, my implant has become active. It has bothered me considerably during the show. And I find that fairly amazing. John, do you have any last little thing you'd like to say to us?
Well, I guess our friends found the show interesting as well. It's been great to be on the show. And it's been great to answer the questions from the listeners.
John, thank you very much for being with us. Thank you for your courage, and thank you for the extraordinary information that you have given to this world. Ignored now, but not always. There will come a time when information like this is seen by the world for the incredible value that it possesses. John Smith, scientist, prominent member of his community, abductee, implant recipient. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Next week on Dreamland, Lawrence Joseph Apocalypse 2012. Don't miss it. Don't ever miss a week of Dreamland. That's a big mistake.
This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge. Don't miss a single week, and tell your friends about our unique program. Our Dreamland crew is Evan Ross on sound, Dana Augustine on program art, Daniel Stegall, webmaster, and I'm your Dreamland announcer, Brian Arnold. Thank you very much for listening.